Okay, so of course it's always a huge pleasure to come here and to have the chance for discussions this week. And wants to fall off, I'm afraid. So in any case, what I'd like to tell you about today is this new system that we've been studying, yttrium iron 2 aluminum 10. And in my talk, I'd like to convince you that this is a material that just naturally forms very close to the onset of ferromagnetic water, just as it is. And so this is a project that we've been working on in my group at Stony Brook and at Brookhaven for several years. And we're also very happy to have the inclusion of our colleagues Igor Zalizniak and Alexei Svelik more recently on this project. I'm going to show you some USR data at the end of the talk, and that's thanks to Lei Xu and Doug McLaughlin, and also some recent neutron scattering measurements that we've carried out ourselves, thanks to Jose Rodriguez, who is the instrument scientist on MACS at NIST, and Colin Broholm. So by way of introduction, I would say that we're at the point where we understand that quantum critical points are sort of a natural part of the phase diagrams of essentially every strongly correlated system that you can imagine, and that largely due to work, for instance, on the F electron-based heavy fermions. Are you guys okay without this?
Yeah, maybe for the recording.
Yeah, well, I'm having an issue with gravity.
Yeah, I'll try that, but we'll see.
Anyway, okay. So quantum critical points are sort of a natural part of the phase diagrams for strongly correlated systems any time where you have a competition between different ordered states. And then I think that a lot of what we know in detail about these quantum critical points have come from our study of the heavy fermions. And I think you could fairly say that as a result of that, that we have studied pretty seriously the breakdown of normal metallic behavior that occurs near such quantum critical points in these metallic systems. In some cases, there's also a more complicated phase or more interesting phase transition where you have not only the collapse of an order parameter, but also the possibility that the Fermi surface volume should change. Our hope, I think, is that in some way we can attach individual materials to what we might call a universal phase diagram, where the stability of, say, an ordered phase is driven on the one hand by hybridization and on the other hand by some sort of frustration parameter. So that's, of course, the good news. And I would say that from the point of view of the experiments, however, in order to make progress on this, we think that it would be convenient if we could extend this sort of phenomenology into d-electron systems. And if we were just to write down our wish list, the best thing, of course, would be if we could find a system where we don't require any fine-tuning. It just magically forms near a quantum critical point. This is really important because we won't need to use pressure cells or something like that, and that would limit the sorts of experiments that we could do. And importantly, we wouldn't need to change the composition to get to the quantum critical point. That always introduces the specter of disorder. And finally, we don't want to go to really, really low temperatures. We want to have robust quantum criticality, which dominates in a convenient range of temperatures. And if we're, while we're at it, we can add to our crazy list of requirements that it would be, fantastic if we could also show that all the experimental observations could be tied together with some underlying free energy. So what I'd like to do today is introduce you to a material that to a great extent actually satisfies all four of these requirements. So it's also convenient that this material is related to ferromagnetism. I would just introduce you here to the current thinking on metallic ferromagnets. It's contained in this phase diagram, which is controlled by temperature, by some tuning parameter, let's say pressure, and by field. So it is believed that for clean ferromagnets, that if you start with a high enough Curie temperature, and you suppress the Curie temperature, when it becomes small enough, at the end, it will drop. The Curie temperature will drop discontinuously to zero at a first order phase transition. And this has been substantiated in pressure experiments on these, at least these two materials. On the other hand, if you use doping or some technique like this to reduce the Curie temperature, you find something different, which is that this transition becomes continuous. That means that TC goes all the way down to zero. And what you inevitably find is that you see mean field-like behavior there. You don't actually see quantum critical behavior. And even worse, in some cases, compositional inhomogeneities in the material coupled with the enhanced susceptibility leads to interesting phenomena such as the Griffiths phase. And that would, of course, obscure any quantum criticality that would be present. So the current thinking is that in metallic ferromagnets, you would not expect to see quantum criticality. All right, so let me tell you about a material that may ask you to suspend your disbelief.
Just for the point of discussion, I think it might be fair to add that at least one heavy fermion metallic case in which the observation seems to fall beyond this sort of...
You're speaking of ytterbium nickel phosphorus?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the jury is still out on that one. It is said to be quasi-one-dimensional, but as far as I know, there hasn't really been a scaling analysis that has been made public anyway. And so what's known at the moment anyway is that you can suppress the ordering temperature to zero. That is what is known.
At least the measure of the transitions are second order.
That's true. That's true, but that's not necessarily, convincing.
I just meant that it doesn't have to be the wind that's indicated.
Sorry?
The diagram that's shown suggesting universal behavior of first order phase transition, at least it's violated in that case.
Well. If you don't want to hear the rest of the talk, at the end I'm going to agree with you in that I think that that's an encouraging system where the low dimensionality might give you the out, just as will be the case for the yttrium iron to aluminum 10. I'm just saying that as an experimental matter, that has not yet been proven. All that's been proven so far is that you can form using doping, you can make a continuous phase transition at zero temperature.
You've already said you could do that anyway with disorder.
Correct. That is exactly my point. That when I say doping, you're all supposed to, immediately think of disorder. I am not saying that that is what is important. I mean, I think that it's worthwhile to do the scaling analysis and find out, for sure that it's quantum critical. My personal feeling is you got a good shot at it. Not so much you personally, but somebody. All right. So the material I'd like to tell you about today is this one, yttrium iron 2 aluminum 10. And its structure is shown here at the left. It is composed of planes, iron square nets. Well, they're not exactly square, but very close to square. And the iron-iron distance here is about 10% different from the iron-iron distance between the planes. But you can see that there's there are large numbers of aluminum atoms that are in between the planes. And so at a minimum here, we would imagine that the iron-aluminum hybridization should be important in this system. I'd like to point out to you that this is an F-electron-free compound. Yttrium has no F electrons. And so all the correlations that we're going to be looking at here are going to be associated with the iron. The experiments that I'm going to tell you about were carried out on single crystals that we made from an aluminum flux. And we've done X-ray diffraction experiments that substantiate that this is a stoichiometric compound, meaning yttrium 1, iron 2, aluminum 10, and there's no detectable aluminum iron site disorder at our detection level, which is about 1%. All right, so here are this is a plot of the AC susceptibility as a function of temperature, and we've placed the field in all three crystallographic directions. The blue and the black data here are for the field lying in the iron plane, and you can see there's a strong divergence of the susceptibility as you lower the temperature. However, if we place the field perpendicular to the planes, the divergence is cut off, and there's about a factor of 30 difference in the susceptibility at the base temperature here. And so taken together, those experiments would tell you that this is a material that is magnetically quasi-two-dimensional. And since we associate the divergence of the susceptibility with being on the high temperature side of a phase transition, we would also say that this is a material that is apparently close let's say, a ferromagnetic phase transition. However, I'll show you that the MuSR experiments show that there is no sign of magnetic order, at least above 20 millicurie. We've also been able to fit the data between 100 degrees and 800 degrees to a Curie-Weiss law, and this gives us a moment which is about 0.4 magnetons per iron. This is, of course, a small moment. It's less than you would expect from any of the Hund's rule configurations for iron. And it suggests that the way you should think the origin of this moment most likely comes from that it is generated in some sort of a band through residual interactions. So that is an itinerant sort of ferromagnetic scenario. All right, so if we have a ferromagnet, we would imagine then that magnetic fields would do the job of suppressing the fluctuations, and indeed that is the case. Here again are the AC susceptibility measurements as a function of temperature, and now we've looked at different DC fields. The black data are the ones that I showed you in the previous slide, and they have this nice power law divergence. The exponent I forgot to mention is 1.4, so quite strong. As we apply magnetic field, the divergence is suppressed, and at high enough field, the susceptibility becomes almost temperature independent, which is what we would expect for a Fermi liquid. So these data then would suggest somehow that at least in the limit that B equals zero, we have a quantum critical system, and as we increase the field, at least at low temperatures, we experience a Fermi liquid. And so we wonder then, is there some sort of a temperature scale that would separate those two behaviors? And the answer is, of course, yes. Here, I should mention that the DC susceptibilities show you basically the same thing. And so we've taken these data, I took the temperature derivative and plotted as a function of temperature, and you can see that there's this maximum. And we're going to take this maximum as the temperature scale T star. And it's plotted here. You can see that it increases with field, and it fits approximately to b to the power 0.6. So if there's a correspondence between the temperature and the field scales, as I've indicated here, the next thing that you might imagine is, in fact, that there is scaling, and indeed there is. We've taken the DC susceptibility data from the previous plot. We take the temperature derivative just to remove any small temperature-independent parts of the susceptibility that are not critical. And we plotted the result as a function not of temperature, but of temperature divided by b to the power 0.6. And we've multiplied it by this power b, and you can see that there's a very good scaling collapse. And this is valid for fields from 0.01 tesla up to 6 tesla. That's our entire measurement range, and for temperatures as large as 30 degrees. So the scaling collapse then we will explain in terms of the free energy, and we specify the free energy that I've given here. It has the attributes that it is free energy that obeys hyperscaling, and in addition, we have made the assumption that there's a single divergent time scale in this problem, despite the fact that there are several things that perhaps could become critical. We're assuming that it is just the magnetic fluctuations and not the quasiparticle modes or something like that. So from this free energy, we can then just write down this expression for dchi dt, which is the quantity that is scaled here. And so by comparing this expression to the figure, we can just write down the properties of the values of the exponents. And what we find is that the dynamical exponent z divided by yb, which is the critical exponent associated with field tuning, is 0.6, and separately that d equals z. So those are the requirements of the scaling that we have here.
Madam, sorry, can I ask, where did the d equals z come from?
So we have two expressions. The first is that d over yb minus 2 is equal to 1.4. That's the first, minus 1.4. And secondly, that we have z over yb equals 0.6. And so we solve these two equations simultaneously, and that gives us d equals z and z over yb equals 0.6. Okay. So the first thing, of course, that you'd want to do is you want to ask yourself whether this, in fact, is consistent with the Hertz-Millis-Maria theory for a dirty ferromagnet, where you have d equals e equals 3. And at the surface of it, it looks similar. We have a value of gamma equals 1.4 that comes from this analysis in Hertz-Millis. That would be 4/3. We have to have z over y equals a half. This comes from the equation of state, and we have 0.6. And so at the surface of it, you could say, well, this is a good agreement with Hertzmillers. But for your comparison, I've plotted up here at the upper right the best scaling that we can get from the Hertzmillers, where I've held a 0.5 exponent fixed, and then I've considered the residuals for different values of gamma. And you can see that for 1.35, this is the best scaling that is possible, and that it is inferior to the scaling that we found for our own exponents. I would also say that if we took the 1 Tesla data set as the master curve, and then we calculated the residuals for a wide range of different values of exponents on this axis and this axis, and you can see how sharply peaked the residuals are minimized for a particular value of the exponents, which is 0.59 and 1.4. And so we would argue then that there is a substantial difference between the scaling exponents that we found in Hertzmillers. But as you'll see as the talk goes on, there are other reasons why this difference is significant. All right. So as I said, we have now a particular form of the free energy. And what we would like to do is to propose a scaling function that would reproduce for us the low temperature and low field properties of the things that we measure. So in this slide, I'll show you how we constructed that. These are the temperature derivatives of the magnetization as a function of temperature, different fields. The argument where this dmdt is a maximum gives us a parameter A. And I should have mentioned that we just are going to take this as the form for our scaling function. This was not a case of divine intervention. This is a form that was based on a scaling function that was first proposed by Pierce Coleman for cerium, copper, 6, gold, and then more recently for ytterbium, aluminum, boron for both quantum critical systems. And so we can get the value of this parameter A from these data.
I don't quite understand the statement. So the scaling function is supposed to come out of the theory. So this is just a sort of an ensemble.
That's correct.
One scale.
That's right.
Maybe it doesn't matter much what the scaling function really looks like. Is that the idea?
That is correct. And the hope, of course, is one day there would be a theory that would explain this. Yeah. But I'm not aware of any such theory. All right. So using that same parameter, the red line is a comparison. Now there are no parameters that are left that overlies the data quite well. So that you're not of the feeling that this power law, this logarithmic scale here hides a multitude of sins. Here is the same scaling plot, but here on a linear scale. And you can see that the scaling collapse is equally good and that the scaling function works quite well. So the scaling function then does, as I say, propose 2 different sorts of behavior. In the quantum critical regime, that happens when you have small fields. You find that the susceptibility diverges like T to the minus gamma, which is what we see. On the other hand, if we're in the Fermi liquid regime, which is at low temperatures as we lower the field, we see that the magnetization follows this power law. The power that you would get from the susceptibility, not the magnetization, should give you a slope of 0.8, but the best fit to the data gives 0.83. And it also tells us that at 1.8 degrees that we're not really all the way down into the Fermi liquid regime quite yet. So we would say that the scaling function has some degree of success in describing the magnetization, but in order to be really successful, we want to test it against some other experimental quantity. So that would be the specific heat. And the free energy that we proposed for the magnetization would also suggest that there's quantum critical scaling in this system as well. So in particular, taking our free energy, the specific heat should follow this expression. And since we have D equals Z, it becomes quite simple in that it depends only on the scaling function, which is B over T. So if we were to expand this function into a part that is field independent and a part which contains all the field dependents, what we would find is that in zero field, the specific heat divergence is not a power law, but is at most logarithmic. And so here are the data. And you can see that perhaps it's not the most stunning demonstration of a log, but at least for an order of magnitude in temperature, you get a reasonable logarithmic fit. And I would say, don't worry too much about this. This is really the limit of our accuracy. This is C over T. Whatever noise we have is going to be really amplified here at low temperatures.
Is that A? That A is not the same A as...
No. Sorry. Good catch. No, this is just another A.
So this is a test that D is equal to zero, right? It's close.
Exactly. It could be. I think that if you wanted to plot this as a log-log plot, that there would be a linear regime and there would be a small value of an apparent exponent that's associated with it. The argument is just that the data would be consistent with a logarithm, and that's, would be consistent with the rest of the argument. Okay. So the logarithmic divergence of C over T is the result of D equals Z, most definitely. And so like the susceptibility, as we apply a magnetic field, we see that the divergence in C over T, which is the black data set, is suppressed. And at the highest fields, we get a relatively constant C over T, again, telling us that we're in the Fermi-Legrand regime. So the other thing that this expression tells us is since this term is a constant, that the C over T should actually just scale by itself as a function of B over T, or T over B, if you like. And so we take the data in the middle, and we do the scaling collapse, T over B to the 0.6, and the data, at least between a half a tesla and 7 tesla, and now for temperatures which range from about 300 millikelvin up to about 7 degrees, have a reasonable collapse, as I've indicated here. The scaling function here is connected through the free energy to the scaling function that we found in the magnetization, and I won't bore you with the details, but the red line is the scaling function that was determined in that way, and again, it's a pretty good description of the data. So we would argue that both the magnetization and the specific heat could be described by the same underlying free energy with the same set of exponents.
I get the plus track and the same scaling function?
The scaling functions are not identical, but if we what we started with was the ansatz for the scaling function in the magnetization. That implies that
the free derivative of the free energy.
So. Exactly. And so then, if we take that same, that deduced scaling function for the free energy, do another derivative, this time with respect to temperature, mm-hmm. Then we can find what the scaling function for the specific heat would be.
You've made an assumption there. Sorry,
yes.
I'm not used to doing this, but you're making assumption that the constant in your integrator doesn't depend on temperature.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And to the extent that this describes the data, that's a reasonable assumption. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So the scaling function should tell us what the properties of the measured quantities are in the low temperature and the low field limits, and the quantum critical limit and the Fermi liquid limit. And I won't explain this in depth. But in the quantum critical limit, the scaling function suggests that C over T should diverge logarithmically, as I said, but that there is a correction of this sort. And you can see then that C over T as a function of B should have a maximum, and that is, in fact, what we see from the measurements. So this is C over T plotted not as a function of T, but as a function of B. On the other hand, if we're in the Fermi liquid limit, we expect to see that the Sommerfeld constant C over T should diverge logarithmically. And that seems to be the case, except here at 0.5 Kelvin, we are still not 100% into the Fermi liquid regime. That's why it saturates like this. Okay, so just to summarize, we have a single free energy, and we will propose the most generic form to be like this, where there is a field-independent part and a field-dependent part, and that this free energy and an ansatz for the scaling function in the free energy can generate essentially the low temperature and low field properties that we see in both the susceptibility and in the specific heat. All right. The I guess, the gold standard for determining whether something is near a quantum critical point involves divergences of the Grunheisen parameters. What I've shown you here is the magnetic Grunheisen parameter that we can determine experimentally, because we have susceptibility measurements, we have specific heat measurements. And so by putting in the values that would have come from our free energy, we can see that the numerator will diverge more quickly than the denominator in this quantity. And indeed, the data support this theoretical claim. The black data shows a divergence of a strong divergence of the magnetic Grunheisen parameter. These are data now. And as we increase the magnetic field, you can see the divergence is suppressed. And so that tells us then that the magnetic field is really a tuning parameter for proximity, for the strength of the critical fluctuations. So up to this time, I've said that it seems like this is a material that is near a ferromagnetic critical point. And that argument was based largely on the size of the susceptibility. Remember that the susceptibility that you measure in a magnetometer is the Q equals zero or uniform susceptibility. So when it diverges, it is a suggestion that you're close to a ferromagnetic phase transition. However, if we compute the Sommerfeld-Wilson ratio, which is determined experimentally as the ratio of the susceptibility to gamma, it should go like b to the minus 0.9 over log b. So it, too, is not going to be constant. And so, at least in the Fermi liquid regime, that tells us that we can't explain the size of the susceptibility entirely by the quasi-particle mass, that we also have to introduce some sort of Stoner-like enhancement of the quasi-particles to explain why the susceptibility is diverges more strongly than the Sommerfeld constant does. I would comment also that we have NMR measurements that were carried out by our colleagues in Dresden. It was found that 1 over T1T is proportional to the Sommerfeld constant C over T. And that's another piece of evidence that we're close to a ferromagnetic critical point because NMR is also a local probe. Okay. So given all of that, the question that is no doubt on your mind is that you wonder what sort of phase transition this really is. Is it just one where you have the appearance of a spontaneous moment? Or is it possible as well that since we're in a metal, that the electrons could be involved as well? And so to answer that question, we've measured the electrical resistivity. And I suppose I hadn't told you previously that this is a metal, here are the data that support that claim. What we've done is we've measured the anisotropy in the resistivity using what's called the Montgomery method. So this is a technique where you do a sequence of measurements with the current in different directions with respect to the crystal axes. So here is the resistivity for the current along the A direction and the C direction. They're very similar. For the B direction here. This is the iron plane. This is perpendicular to the iron plane. And so you can see that the resistivity is metallic, but not amazingly so, in that there's a relatively mild temperature dependence, and that the residual resistivity in both cases is relatively high. We were a little surprised by this initially because, as I said, we raised these crystals up from small molecules, and we believe that they are, in fact, very good quality crystals. We've never been able to find any suggestion of disorder in them. And indeed, there's very little sample dependence that we would find. The difference in the values that you find here for these four different samples, I would say, is consistent with our ability to measure the distance between the contacts. Usually sample dependence is a good indication that you have disorder in your system, and we have not been able to find that. So our belief is that this is, in some sense, a bad metal, in that the scattering here is not, strictly speaking, due just to the impurities. In the AC plane, the resistance is about 2,000 ohms per square, which is a substantial amount. So we can say that the anisotropy of the resistivity is not so much. It's only a factor of two. And more importantly, you can see it's temperature independent. And so that, I guess, implies that it has nothing to do with the quantum critical properties that we saw in the specific heat and the susceptibility, that this anisotropy is a feature that is built into the material at the level of the electronic structure. It is directly related, let's say, to the layered structure of the material.
So Megan, the magnetism, it was anisotropic as well?
It was much more anisotropic. So the DC susceptibility was about a factor of 30 bigger when the field was in the plane versus perpendicular to the plane. We only have about a factor of 2 here.
Okay.
Plus, the anisotropy and the susceptibility was only evident at low temperature. There was no anisotropy at high temperature. Okay. So let's see. So the other thing to point out to you is that the in-plane resistivity is the largest, and so that is where the scattering is the strongest, that is perhaps a little surprising that the resistivity between the planes is actually lower than the resistivity in the planes. We checked to see whether magnetic fields could change the resistivity significantly, because it was, of course, very effective in changing the susceptibility of the specific heat. And those results are shown here on the right. So the zero field data are the black points. And you can see that there's a small upturn in the resistivity at the lowest temperatures. But it doesn't just keep on diverging. It eventually saturates. If we apply a field which is perpendicular to the planes, there's not much difference to the resistivity. But if we place the field in the iron planes, we can see that we suppress most of the upturn in the resistivity. Finally, I point out to you. Is it a quadratic? Just wait till the next slide. So the final point I would just make is that in every experiment, the quantum critical phenomena are represented over a different range of field and temperature that largely has to do with the non-critical parts. So in the case of the resistivity, we have a very small quantum critical. I'm assuming that the fact that it changes as a function of field, that it's related to quantum criticality, which is not yet proven to you, of course, that here you have just a few percent effect, whereas in the case of the susceptibility and the specific heat, you can basically suppress the whole thing with similar fields. So there's only a small part of the resistivity which is related to the alleged quantum criticality.
So I guess it's interesting that at least for this system, it's not like what happens in many other cases where you can see parametrically, like scale in other measurements, mm-hmm. resistivity gives you T squared.
Wait till the next slide. Okay.
Sorry, maybe I just misunderstood the figure. So the colors on the right hand side figure the same as on the left?
No.
Subtract the background?
No. Sorry for that. These are just my favorite colors for slides.
Okay.
So imagine that these are on two different pages.
Okay.
So this is A, B, and C over here, and it's different fields over here. Apology. I never even noticed that.
But what confuses me is just the field was in different directions, so I was looking at it, it's like, what?
I can see that it's confusing. Apologies for that. So we could imagine different reasons why we have this resistive upturn. I mean, one is essentially that the conduction electrons in the system are somehow weakly coupled to the quantum critical fluctuations, and so you get some additional scattering as the quantum critical fluctuations build up at lower temperatures. There could be some sort of influence on the Fermi surface due to the increased scattering. Perhaps part of the Fermi surface has been destroyed and the resistance goes up. Eventually it gets cut off because there's the rest of the Fermi surface. Or finally, that this is just an impurity Kondo effect. And indeed, it certainly looks like that to some extent. And so I'd like to deal with some of those questions in the next page. So we've carried out more detailed measurements of the resistivity. This is all with the current in the AC plane, in the iron plane. We have 0 Tesla here, 14 Tesla, and a more extended range of temperatures. And what I'd like to tell you is that if we subtract the 0 Tesla data from the infield data to create the quantum critical resistivity, if you like, that the result can actually be scaled as a function of T over B to the 0.6, just like everything else. So these data here are scaled on the right for a wide range of fields, now up to 14 Tesla, and from temperatures of 0.2 Kelvin up to 50 Kelvin. The properties of this scaling apparently are that we have a Fermi liquid regime when the fields are when the temperature is small and the field is large. And here we find that this excess resistivity, which is this resistivity, is T squared with a coefficient A of B, which diverges like B to the minus 0.6, which is, I think, Chimiao's question. On the other hand, if we are in the quantum critical regime where the field is small and the temperature is decreasing, here we find a rather different temperature dependence. It's linear with respect to temperature. So this doesn't necessarily help us understand what the origin of the resistivity is, other than certainly the electrons feel the quantum critical fluctuations in some way. It is not simple spin disorder scattering, for in this case, the resistivity and the magnetization must be somehow proportional to each other. And from the scaling that we have already demonstrated for the magnetization and for these resistivity scaling, there's no way that they could be proportional to each other. So this is not simple spin disorder scattering.
So you're saying the magnetoresistance somehow follows?
Excuse me?
The better role is the magnetoresistance.
That's correct. So this is just a construct which allows us to pick off the part of the resistivity which can be controlled by field. There's another contribution to the resistivity, which is, you know, sort of 90% of the overall resistivity at the lowest temperatures, right? This is, what I'm showing you here is exactly the measured resistivity. There's 88 microohm centimeters and down, which is just, you know, not critical in this sense. So
I'm confused about your quantum critical expression that delta rho doesn't have any V dependence when V is small. The second block, the line that says quantum critical.
Yes, this one?
Yeah, you say delta rho is C times T, but there's no...
Yes, so there's no B dependence to that. That is absolutely correct, that it goes towards a constant value as T goes to as T over B to the 0.6 becomes large.
That means for B small, delta rho is independent of B, but I'm confused about how that's possible.
Well, but there's probably a small B squared term, but maybe it's just small because the temperature is so large.
My hypothesis is that I guess...
No, I'm just not understanding why delta rho doesn't go to zero as B goes to zero.
Because you defined it that way, right?
I
know. Delta rho is defined as rho of B minus rho of B of zero. It's got to go to zero as B goes to zero. Yeah. So I'm functionally confused, not physics. I'm probably physics confused also. But
I think so the plot definitely shows that delta rho does approach zero, right? So
I think probably the answer to this is that there's probably a correction here, which is going to contain the field dependence. That is, so the temperature dependence is stronger than the field dependence. So, you know, the correct way probably to do this would be to study the x, you know, let's call this scaling parameter x. We should look at the full x dependence as this becomes large and not focus just on the constant part of it. I think that's the most likely resolution to your question.
Well, it's like zero, yeah.
Yeah, so the corrections would be significant at that point. So I don't know in detail the answer to your question, but it is my expectation based on, you know, physical reasonableness that the field and the temperature must, though, at least at zero field, you know, the temperature dependence is very weak, but the field dependence is apparently not that weak.
Yeah. So can I, with bare eyes, see where is the linear T regime, or is it impossible to?
So the answer is probably not. I have magnetoresistance data on my computer, and so maybe you guys would like to look at that later.
Okay, and the coefficient? C is negative coefficient,
right? Yes, that must be the case. And that has to do with the definition of delta rho. Okay, so spin disorder scattering, because there's no way to make the critical resistivity and the magnetization proportional to each other. The standard picture where you have separate quasi-particles and separate fluctuating moments is not going to work in this system. The other thing that you fans of the Kondo effect might notice is that this upturn in the resistivity looks an awful lot like what you would expect in a classic Kondo problem, but again, there the scaling parameter is going to be T over B, not the one that we see. And so this doesn't rule out the possibility of a more exotic kind of Kondo effect. And indeed, I almost believe that given the rest of the data that I'll show you, but this is not the standard Kondo effect. All right, so moving on. The last two things I want to show you about are some new experiments that we've carried out that are aimed at probing the dynamics at low temperatures. And so the first thing is going to be muon spin rotation experiments, again, carried out by Lei Xu and Doug McLaughlin. And here's a plot of the muon lifetime asymmetry for two temperatures. The blue is 1 degree and the red is 20 millikelvin, and you can see that there's a significant temperature dependence between those two. And this was not observed in previous efforts to do this experiment based on powers. And so in this case, the field is in the AC plane. If you look at that asymmetry as a function of time, but at different fields, from small fields up to large fields, you can amazingly, as it turns out, fit the data to just a simple exponential. And that's the black line that you see here in each of the fields. And the time scale that you get from each of those fits is shown in the plot at the right. And that time scale goes like the field to the power minus 0.8. Now, for those of us who have worked in systems of this sort in the past, this was an interesting result. First is that we find that there's only a single time scale that is appropriate here. And that was a huge win because if disorder were important, we'd see glassiness, we'd see stretched exponentials, we'd see all sorts of terrible things. But this is a very simple sort of situation. And so we were encouraged then to think about what we had seen in other quantum critical systems. And in particular, this is the distribution of the lifetimes, the asymmetry. And if it can be, if there is not a significant spatial variation in this quantity, it can scale as a function of T over H to this power gamma. And this is what was worked out in the system uranium copper four plating that we studied a long time ago. The time scale that comes out of these measurements via the fluctuation dissipation theorem can be then used to show that we would expect to have omega over T scaling in chi double prime under these circumstances. And really the only thing that is built into this is that the muon asymmetry is localized, and so therefore chi double prime should be Q independent. So we had to, of course, check that out. So I should say before I leave that this assumption that we have the time divided by field scaling may be correct. These data are scaled here, and this exponent 0.8 comes from this fit, and well, it scales or not. All right. The last thing I want to show you is inelastic neutron scattering measurements that we carried out at the MAX triple axis spectrometer at NIST. We used two coal lined single crystals of yttrium-iron 2, aluminum 10 with a total mass of about 2 grams. And as I've shown you, magnetic field suppresses the critical fluctuations. And so we're going to use the 9 Tesla measurement as a background, which will allow us to isolate the critical part of the scattering. So what I'm showing you here is a contour plot which shows the scattering, in this case for a fixed energy transfer of 0.5 millivolts. And this is going to be, this is the OKL scattering plane. Okay?
Maybe I just completely forgot. You said what is the structure of the compound?
So it's a layered structure. I don't think you were asking me for the details. But this is going to be the OKL. So K is in the B direction, that's perpendicular to the planes, and L is in the planes.
It's supposed to be frustrated if we were.
So where is this structure?
It's it's a square net, or almost square net. I can show you the structure again if you like.
Yep.
No? Orthorhombic, correct?
It is orthorhombic, but the distortion from tetragonal is very small, which is why I say it's almost a square net. All right, so that is the structure. So the K is perpendicular to the planes, the L is in the planes. Okay? So what you can see is that there's this streak of scattering that goes along the OOL direction. And when we subtract the 9 Tesla data set, which allows us to estimate the background, because at 9 Tesla we think that there are no critical fluctuations present, what you get is the difference plot that is shown here at the right. This is for an energy transfer of 0.5 millivolts. So these are excitations that have an energy of 0.5 millivolts within the within the energy resolution of the machine. Here's the same measurement, but now we have an energy transfer of 1 millivolt. And you can see that it is stronger, it is weaker. So this is scattering that gets stronger at lower energies, which is what you expect for critical scattering.
What's the typical resolution? So this is what, the time of flight experiment?
No, MAX is at its heart a triple axis spectrometer. So you have a fixed energy transfer, which has a certain energy resolution, which is, you know, typically 10% at E equals zero. It's not a machine where you can, it is tailor-made to show you the Q dependence of the scattering at a fixed energy.
Which direction is this?
This direction is the L direction, so that lies in the critical plane.
In the plane.
This is the direction perpendicular. Okay?
But there's an ask, what is the energy resolution of the machine?
So it's about 10% at E equals zero.
And what?
So if you choose an energy, nominally where the energy transfer is zero, so elastic scattering, the width of a quasi-elastic peak would be about 10% of the incident energy. So maybe in this case 0.1 millivolts or something like that.
So could you repeat your interpretation? Because when I see the right, it seems to me that at lower energy, mm-hmm. I have only 1 point at zero.
1 point at zero.
So
this is a lower energy transfer, this is a higher energy transfer. So if we have pi going to the minus something,
sorry.
This would be stronger, this would be weaker.
Okay. So it seems it's quasi 2D.
So this is exactly going to be the conclusion. Let me just make a few comments before I move on to showing you just the slight amount of analysis that would be possible for these data. The first is that you can see the Bragg peaks in this picture, and I can tell you that there are no new antiferromagnetic Bragg peaks that are detected, and the nuclear peaks are not temperature dependent, so there's no suggestion of any kind of long-range order in this system. The other thing that you can see is that the scattering is very weak. Each of these panels took 12 hours to obtain, and this is on the strongest, highest intensity triple axis spectrometer in North America. So what we conclude from that is this is no surprise. I told you at the beginning of the talk that the iron moment was very small, 0.4 Bohr magnetons per iron. So that is the integrated weight that you would find if you summed up over all wave vectors and all energies. And that is why the scattering is very weak. And in fact, is only possible because of, I think there's probably maybe only one other machine in the world where you would be able to find these data. All right, so here then is just a small amount of analysis. I've blown up here the half a millivolt energy transfer, and this is the difference. And so everything that you see here is allegedly critical fluctuations. So this is the OOL direction, and we would claim that the scattering is not dependent on L. To show you that in a little bit more detail, we've cut across this, so we've summed over the K direction. The K direction is between the planes, and we've plotted that in the center here. So the open circles down here are the 9 Tesla data set, so this is the background level. The blue data are at 1 millivolt, the red is at 0.5 millivolt energy transfer, this is 1 millivolt energy transfer, I think we can say that the scattering is independent of L. The scattering in the iron plane itself is not Q-dependent, that is what we expect for localized fluctuations. Of course, we can see that there is modulation in the k direction. That is, if you cut across this ridge of scattering at half a millivolt and at 1 millivolt, you get the data here. Here I've summed over all L because L is now an irrelevant variable. And you can see that the width of these two peaks is really similar. It's about 2 reciprocal lattice units. So there is modulation in the direction perpendicular to the planes, but the width of it is enormous. And so you conclude from that that the correlations between the planes are very weak. But even so, that Q dependence is stronger than anything you would find in the planes themselves. So I realize that we've only shown you 2 energies, and obviously we continue to work on this. But the data so far seem to suggest that we have a very weak Q dependence, which is all related to the interplanar coupling. And it appears as if that Q dependence is independent of the energy dependence, meaning that the width is the same for 2 different energies. And so that's at least suggestive that the energy and the wave vector dependencies would decouple. Again, something that we've seen in local quantum critical systems. And so finally, I would just like to conclude by telling you that it's sort of a miracle that we met yttrium ion 2 aluminum 10. I'd like to tell you that we had planned it, but in fact, it was just amazing to find that this is just a system that the lower down in temperature you go, the susceptibility just keeps going up. It wants to be ferromagnetic, but can't quite manage it. I've shown you that we can explain the magnetic and thermal data based on a single free energy, and that the critical exponents that we found are not mean field-like. So as Chi Miao brought up, I think at the beginning of the talk, we feel that the reason that this compound somehow avoids the mean field scenario, which most ferromagnets previously have been observed to have, is because of its low dimensionality. This is clearly a system that's below its upper critical dimension. We think that it's still something of a question as to how the conduction electrons couple into the critical fluctuations in this system, and our early dynamical measurements are very encouraging that the in-plane fluctuations are very highly localized. Thank you very much.
I guess you guys self-organize the discussion.
Okay.
Megan, I have a question which is admittedly somewhat theoretical, but since you were playing with the scaling functions. So we were taught that in the ferromagnetic case, because that's right, the statement is that proximity to the ferromagnet Z should be equal to 3. Right? So
Z should equal 3 in Hertzsprung-Miller. Mm-hmm.
Correct. So now the statement is D is equal to Z, which is undeniable looking at the exponents, like you showed us from the scaling, which suggests that maybe then D is also equal to 3. In which case you would be above the upper critical dimension, and we didn't see any of that.
Correct.
So clearly there is some dichotomy here.
Mm-hmm.
So either one doesn't trust Hertzsprung-Miller and something is majorly wrong with that,
mm-hmm.
or I don't know what, how do you think about this?
So certainly I'm familiar with this argument, and you know, when we were first doing the scaling, I think we were of the opinion initially that maybe the differences between the exponents that we found and those that would be expected for a dirty ferromagnet might not be so significant. But I think that the deeper that we got into the problem, the less we sort of believe that. First, we could show that the differences were statistically significant, and I know that that's not going to be super convincing for everybody. But I think that now that we are starting to do more sophisticated measurements like the neutrons, that what we are seeing is not just a simple metallic system. That the criticality seems like it has more richness than you would expect from Hertzsprung-Miller's Maria.
Oh, having just seen the neutron scattering at the end, I wonder, is it really right to call it an almost ferromagnetic?
I'm really open to that possibility, but I lack words, right? I mean, if it's truly local So, of course, you know, what I'd like to say would be that, you know, if this is really a local transition, I mean, an example, I mean, what we might imagine then is that we're just starting to form the iron moments, you know, that they are somehow being dragged out of this correlated fluid, you know, it's sort of like a Mott Hubbard transition or something, you know, something like that, that we're just starting to form the moments themselves. And that would be the dominant thing that we would get from the neutrons. You understand what I'm saying?
Not really, no.
Okay.
Because you saw a moment there already at high temperature, and that's growing. It's a small number, and then it grows dramatically in many places.
Right. So if you insist on thinking of this as being a magnetic...
The moments there are much bigger than what's accepted when we have them.
That is true. That is very true.
It really looks like And then I just look at the susceptibility. Paramagnet, you have dominant uniform susceptibility. We did a lot of uniform susceptibility measurements. That's growing. But that doesn't tell you that it's growing any more than any other parts of the susceptibility.
Well, I mean, you know, to some extent, it could also be that, you know, mostly when you think about ferromagnets, you might be thinking about insulating ferromagnets. And it's indeed true that the scattering sort of builds up around the nuclear Bragg peaks. But because, you know, we're thinking about something, obviously, which is much more localized than that. And so, you know, maybe it is sort of building up around Bragg peaks. It's just that the width with respect to Q is just enormous, right? There probably is a connection between, you know, the purely localized and the purely itinerant pictures that you might be thinking. I mean, that is what a really localized ferromagnet would look like, right? There would be no measurable, you know,
red. If the correlation line is lattice spacing, then I would call it a paramagnet.
Well, I don't agree that it's a paramagnet.
It's just on the other side of the transition, the correlation line, you know, you have to have infinite correlations.
That's correct. So I guess I'm going to take the fifth, right? I mean, these are the external guys. I don't know how to describe them other than that.
But Megan, so on this point, Leon, but isn't there also the issue that, you know, because you don't quite see the gamma point, right? You count the neutron scattering to see the Q equals zero directly. Mm-hmm. Could it be that what we see is a big, but weak background?
You have many crystals.
Could you show us again, you mean those red points? Could you show us again?
Yeah,
right,
that
was several zones.
Yeah,
that
is exactly correct.
The red points that I look at the zero Tesla data, would be the nuclear peaks?
The Bragg points? Yeah, right. So these are right. Bragg peaks, right?
Right.
And so this is a Bragg peak here, and there's not one there, as it turns out, but yep.
Right. So my question would be, just to clarify Lina's question, so what would be the relative intensity at the peak, at the Bragg peak, I mean, if you subtract the nuclear contribution, purely magnetic, compared to the background somewhere else. Right?
Well,
is the argument, if they're comparable, then it's more like it's uniform, the same everywhere, right?
So I think the answer to that question is, if you look at the difference, okay, you can see that there's black points where the Bragg peaks were before, and so that is the subtraction error, you know, in the Bragg peaks, you know, between 9 Tesla and 0 Tesla.
Right.
And then, you know, this is the level of the background. And so it's not a completely incoherent background. It still has some Q dependence, at least in the directions perpendicular to the planes. It's
right.
Incoherent in the plane.
So, but Lynn, would you be happy if the peaks were much, much stronger than the blue background? Is that your point, that they're not?
These peaks are much stronger than the blue background.
No, I
see. Well, they are...
I would want to see some sharpening of the intensity to be more concentrated around them.
So, this is sort of a standard problem in that looking at the diffuse scattering around what's going to be a nuclear Bragg peak, you know, when you are above the ferromagnetic ordering temperature, is not a walk in the park on a summer day. And so this sort of scattering here is, at a minimum, with the Q resolution that we have in this experiment, we would not be sensitive to ferromagnetic scattering around the Bragg peak, so it could certainly be starting to organize itself there. You know, we're above the Curie temperature, but we could still see some diffuse scattering around those Bragg peaks. That's possible.
Yeah,
But in our experiment, this is mostly what we saw. This is the strong.
Just to clarify, I mean, if you did the experiment on some known material that was ordering,
right,
on some low temperature and low barometric
state,
mm-hmm, it would look quite different.
Absolutely. You would see broadening around the Bragg peaks that would sharpen up as you go towards the transition.
What happens in the other in-plane direction? You're showing only one of the in-plane directions.
This is an experiment in a single scattering plane. I can only tell you what's happening in the scattering plane.
Presumably,
you have to wait.
In the plane, it doesn't matter much, right? Because there is a stimulus if you go into this.
Well, I think the answer is, if it's really localized in this direction, I mean, it would be even weirder if we looked in the transverse direction. And for instance, I would look at the HKO plane and see something different.
So you think it's like a plane of scattering?
Yeah, absolutely. That if you looked at, if in a perfect experiment and your eyes were good neutron detectors, you look down in the plane, it would just all be fluctuating, you know, the same everywhere.
Okay. Maybe now was the time for the chairman to say to thank you again for your talk.
Thank you.